Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
We're going in-depth on the Pilgrim legend. As we head into the Thanksgiving holiday, we're taking this hour to get some historical perspective from writer Nathaniel Philbrick. Later in the hour, we'll revisit my conversation earlier this year about his latest biography, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. But back to a conversation with him in 2006 about his book, Mayflower. Now, if you think you know the story of the voyage of the Mayflower and the settling of Plymouth Colony, Philbrick's history is worth a read for the window it provides into the drama and the deprivation of the Pilgrim legend. I asked him about the story that most of us are taught in elementary school, a story that he said all seems destined from the beginning. And of course, the truth is that they were ordinary people filled with all sorts of doubts and fear and an overwhelming sense of religious purpose.
For me, what brought this story home is that, you know, there was the sense of destiny, but they didn't know what destiny was going to be. And William Bradford, who is the who's of Plymouth Plantation, is one of the great books of American history and literature, and
everybody should read it.
Everybody should read it. You know, yes, he was the governor who made it all possible. He was the rock upon which Plymouth was founded. But just within a few months of their arrival in the New World, he would return to the Mayflower after finding Plymouth Harbor and return to the Mayflower with this good news to discover that his wife, Dorothy, had slipped over the side of the ship and drowned. Just terrible news that, and then they had to continue on and create a new settlement. And so I began to see these were people with issues that went way beyond the destiny of America. Mm-hmm. They had personal situations. They had personal grief and worry and doubts. And for me, it was, you know, a very personal human story.
What I also thought was interesting is you talk about the destiny of this, and you mean that very literally. They felt that this was God's plan.
Absolutely.
For them to do this, right?
Right. Yeah, you know, this was a mission of impossible odds to take their congregation of fellow worshipers 3,000 miles across the ocean into the New World. They only did this because they felt God wanted them to do it. And because otherwise, why subject yourselves and especially your children to this kind of risk and potential deprivation?
Remind us again, Mr. Philbrick, how many set out and how many are still alive when they spot land?
Yeah, they are 102 passengers when they set off from England, plus two dogs, a mm-hmm. spaniel and a mastiff. And by the time they arrive off the coast of New England, a sailor has died and one of the servants, but there's also been a birth. Oceanus has been born. And so there are still 102 of them when they are off the coast of New England in the fall of 1620.
And their population will be much diminished the longer they stay. And we'll talk about that. But they spot land in November of 1620, and they come ashore not where they thought they were going to at the Hudson River, but they end up coming ashore, on the backside of what we think of as Cape Cod today. Is that right?
200 miles off course, yeah.
And in the next few days, they're, you know, rowing on to land and walking around and looking at the new place that they think they're going to settle. And they spot Indians for the first time. And you describe that in a very interesting way. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, you know, this was the huge issue for them. What are the native people going to think about us? And so initially, they can't find any. It's this haunted vacancy. And Miles Standish, their military leader, is leading them on an overland expedition down the beach at Provincetown. And they see some people up ahead. Initially, they think it's some sailors from the Mayflower. But no, these are Indians, and they start, what the Indians do is they start running. They try to get away from them, and Miles Standish says, well, let's pursue. So, you know, here you've got the Pilgrims, you know, with their armor and their muskets running down the beach after them, and they pursue each other for several miles, and eventually the Indians escape. And you know, this is just the beginning of what is going to be a couple of months of very difficult and really scary interactions.
They find a cache of Indian corn, a big basket of it, and their discovery and their decision about what to do with it reverberates, is it fair to say, for years?
I mean, they are presented with the big dilemma. They soon after they spot Indians, they continue down the coast of Cape Cod, where they come across this cache of buried seed, native corn. And, you know, they're in a survival situation already. Their ship is poorly provisioned. They have no confidence that their English grains are going to work in the soils of the New World. And here is some native seed. Should they take it? But if they take it, they're probably going to anger the local Indians. What do you do? They decide to take the seed. And with that, their first act in New England is one of robbery, thievery. And you know, for people of religious faith and devotion, this casts the immediate future of their settlement in not a great light.
That's what I think is the thread that continues through this entire story, is how often their values are tested and the things that they really believe in. What are the things that they're willing to do to survive versus the values that they want this community to stand for? And they're tested for years and years on that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, from the beginning, they had this ideal vision of transporting their congregation as a group to the New World, where they could worship God as they pleased with no interference. But it didn't work out that way. They had their struggle for survival involved them with the local Native Americans. They had to make it up as they were going along. And this improvisation, I think, really is what you see turning them from Englishmen with radical religious beliefs into what will become eventually Americans.
So why don't we learn so much of the dimension that you bring to this story?
Yeah, well, we learn of the story, most of us, in elementary school. And we're taught a child's version of these accounts. And it's the noble, heroic, generous English Native American interaction that blossoms with the first Thanksgiving. And there's many truths to that, but that's about all we learn about it. For me, I know in high school, American history resumed 150 years later with the American Revolution.
Right.
And off we went into learning about America. That's a gap of 150 years.
Why, though?
Because we have this sense of a mythic beginning. You know, for Americans, we need a beginning. You know, we're such a recent people that, you know, it's such an attractive myth to have this cooperative beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
This is the melting pot in utero. But it's not. And yet we don't return to it comfortably, because the native interaction, all the scary stuff that will happen is a 19th century story, the winning of the West. New England, that's not the kind of thing we think happened in New England. But with this, my contention is it all happened in New England in 55 years, and it's time we began. You know, if we're going to understand the founding fathers,
right,
we got to look to the founding myths and realize that there's a lot underneath those myths that we need to understand before we can begin to understand the American Revolution.
I mean, do you think that some of this is because this story is so much more complex, and it doesn't always reveal the settlers in a very good light?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have this image in elementary school, and it's a comfortable myth. But to understand it fully, you have to get into the complexities of Native American culture, which was not, you know, it wasn't this monolithic East-West meets Native culture.
Right.
It was, you know, there are also different perspectives within both sides. And it's very much the way the world is today in terms of competing nations and ethnic groups that don't necessarily understand each other, don't necessarily like each other. But in the case of Plymouth Colony for 55 years, learned how to peacefully coexist. And I think that's where the real lesson is. It's not just the benign tableau of the first Thanksgiving. There were 55 years of very hard work, of give and take, of diplomacy on the brink, but there was peace. I think we've got a lot to learn from that
peace
time.
Until there was war. To Pete in Minneapolis.
Hi. I've heard a lot about these pilgrims sort of coming over and being Puritans and kind of on a mission from God, which is a little disconcerting. Not really complaining. I'm glad we live in the home of the free and so on. But I wanted to know if, what was that? I don't understand what their religion was.
Okay.
And of course, I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Good question.
Oh, very good question. The truth is that the Pilgrims had more in common with a cult than is generally appreciated. They were definitely on a mission from God. They were Puritan separatists, and this meant that they believed that the Church of England was not a holy church, that there were all sorts of impurities that must be dispensed with if they were going to worship God as God intended. And so they had to separate themselves from the rest of England to do that. And this was illegal in England. So they had spent more than a decade in Leiden, Holland, a country with more tolerant religious attitudes. And there had become this very tightly knit congregation that grew to 400 people. And they truly believed that they were their way to God was the right way. And so when they came to America, it was not in search of religious freedom. No, because when decades later, when the Quakers came to New England, they were persecuted. No, they came to practice the way God and they felt intended.
That's such an interesting point, too, because what you're saying is we had the settlers, we have this idea of how religion should be practiced. We're not really a live and let live kind of people.
Oh, no, not at all. As Christians, that did not mean they did not believe in violence. And in the first years of Plymouth Colony, you see, from our standards, horrific acts of violence. Mm-hmm. You see Miles Standish, the military leader, leading a kind of commando hit against the Massachusetts Indians to the north. Massasoit tells them that there is a conspiracy in which those Indians are out to destroy Plymouth Colony. Standish leads this group of half a dozen pilgrims, and they invite a group of Massachusetts warriors into a room of a dwelling and begin to stab the warrior to death with his own knife around his neck on a string. And they cut off the head of this warrior, and Standish returns in triumph to the settlement. The head of the warrior is planted on the top of the fort where they worship every Sunday, and thus was forged an alliance with the Wampanoag sachem that was literally writ in blood to a certain extent. And you know, this is not the image we get of the Pilgrims in elementary school. It is, you know, this was a hard-won peace that involved violence, and, you know, that's not a comforting thought to when you're trying to view American history as coming from a completely benign and positive beginning.
I think at one point you write that even years after the settlement, the colony had begun, that members of this colony are still worshiping with guns at their side.
Yeah,
because this is how violent this society is.
Yeah, in 1627, 7 years after the settlement, there's a Dutch trader who comes to Plymouth Colony. He wrote this very revealing letter in which describes them on a typical Sunday, and they have kind of a parade leading to the fort where they worship, led by Miles Standish and William Bradford, and every man has his musket by his side, not only on his way to church, but beside him as they sit there. This is an armed camp a decade into it. And, no one's taking anything for granted when it comes to personal safety in Plymouth Colony during that first decade.
Let's take another call from Dave in St. Paul.
Hi. My wife is a Mayflower descendant. Her ancestor is John Billington.
Ah.
And a fascinating character.
Absolutely.
Who seemed, from what I've read, more like a modern American than a Puritan, profane, disrespectful toward authority, not particularly religious, and managed to keep his entire family alive during the first winter. I wondered if you could talk about him a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, the Billingtons are one of my favorite families. They were part of what were known as the Strangers. These were almost half the Mayflower did not share the Puritans' beliefs. They were recruited in London, and these were Church of England people who were a little skeptical about where the colony was going. And the Billington family was referred to by William Bradford as the profanest on the Mayflower. And he had two teenage sons who were always getting into trouble. One of them would almost blow up the Mayflower when he was playing with his father's gunpowder. And but this spoke to a fact that there was a real divide from the very beginning in the settlement. And it would only be after that first winter, in which more than half of them would die, that the two sides would become together, because they realized they were in a mutual survival situation. And yet there were factions would remain. The Billingtons were, you know, he did not get along very well with Miles Standish, for example. And so, once again, this is a story of human conflict and drama that is so much more interesting than the Courier Knives print in our imagination in elementary school.
You know, Miles Standish's name, of course, is so familiar. And I wanted to read just a bit of the description that you give us of him in the book. You write, well-educated and well-read, he owned a copy of Homer's The Iliad and Caesar's Commentaries. He appears to have conducted himself with a haughty impulsiveness that didn't endear him to some of the settlers, one of whom later claimed that the Plymouth captain looks like a silly boy and is in utter contempt. Controversial figure.
Oh,
loved
absolutely.
By some, right, for his military accomplishments.
Well, it depended on by some, by all. You know, this remember, it goes with the job description to a certain extent, but he clearly had what we would refer to today as an anger management problem. There are several accounts of him of just blowing up with people and striking true terror in the Native Americans. And it's interesting, Bradford, in almost a calculating way, would use Standish to make some points in New England. But there's a fascinating letter written by their pastor, John Robinson, mm-hmm. who did not come mm-hmm. over on the Mayflower, because the majority of their flock decided to stay in Holland that first year. After the hit on these Indians to the north in Massachusetts, in which Standish returned in triumph with the head of a warrior, they would get a letter from John Robinson who would say to Bradford, you know, you were wrong in doing this. You should have converted these Indians before you killed them. And that, you know, this is not the way to deal with native people in this land. And so, you know, you see in this story, the Pilgrims don't all agree amongst each other. And as a consequence, you begin to see varying points of view that really provide perspective.
We have not talked much about the Indian leaders who emerged as very important in this time. And I thought that you could tell us a bit about Squanto and Massasoit. Am I pronouncing that
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. Who were they and how influential were they in helping the settlers survive? Because they were, weren't they?
Without the intervention of Massasoit, who was the leader of the Wampanoags in southern New England, if without his intervention, they would never have survived that first winter. And he had been in a terrible situation where plagues had from Europe had gone up and down the coast, killing in some cases 90% of the Native Americans, and the neighboring enemies, the Narragansetts, it looked like they might take them over. And so he saw an alliance with the English as a way to resuscitate his people's fortunes. But it was not all that simple, because there was also Squanto. Now, we're taught he is the generous interpreter who shows the English how to plant corn. Well, it turns out Squanto had an agenda of his own from the very beginning. He had been born in Plymouth, the harbor, known as Patuxet by the Indians, had been abducted by an English explorer several years before the arrival of the Pilgrims, had ended up in London, where he learned the English language, and then returned home just before the arrival of the Mayflower as an interpreter to another English explorer. Squanto returned to Plymouth Harbor to find that the community of 2,000 people he had once known was empty of people, whitened bones of the dead remaining from these terrible diseases. But he began to realize that Massasoit and the Wampanoag were vulnerable. He began to have ambitions to become the next Massasoit. And he realized that if ever there was an English settlement in this region, he would become the most influential man, because he could tell the English what he wanted them to think the Indians were saying, and he could tell the Indians what he wanted them to think the English were saying. And that's exactly what he did. He began to inform the Indians that the Pilgrims possessed the plague, buried in a barrel underneath one of their houses, and they could administer it at will, and only he, Squanto, could rescue other Indians. And so people began to look to Squanto rather than Massasoit. About a year into this, both sides, Pilgrim and Indian, began to realize what Squanto was up to. Massasoit wanted his head, literally. Bradford felt he needed an interpreter, so was reluctant. It looked like this alliance might blow apart. Eventually, things calmed down. Eventually, Squanto died under very mysterious circumstances. He may have been poisoned by Massasoit, and once again, they were on track.
Is it fair to say, do you think, that, and we know that ultimately they would go to war against some of the Indian communities, but is it fair to say that although there were skirmishes occurring between the settlers and the Indians, that for the most part the Indians wanted to get along with the English?
Yes, and in fact both sides realized that, because after those first 5 years, the Wampanoags realized, you know, if we don't have the English, the Narragansetts are going to take us over. And the English realized if we don't have the Wampanoags, all the rest of the Indians are going to annihilate us. Mm-hmm. And so that first generation, Massasoit and Bradford, understood from the very beginning that they literally needed each other to survive. What you see is with the second generation, it's shifting. Because that second generation grew up under a whole different group of circumstances, and they began to take the other for granted. The young English said, you know, we want the lands that those Indians are on. And the young warriors of the Wampanoag began to say, what good are these English to us? They're taking this place over. And so they forget the fact that, wait a minute, they do really still need each other, mm-hmm. but they begin to see it otherwise.
Let's take another call from Jeanette in Minneapolis.
Hi. There's a gentleman by the name of William B. Newell, who's the former chair of the University of Connecticut Anthropology Department. And his research, which was done with documents of Holland, the colonial documentation, history, letters, reports from colonial officials and their superiors, King of England, et cetera, that show that that first Thanksgiving is really a myth.
Hmm. Yeah.
700 men, women, and children, Native Americans, were murdered by mercenaries.
Did that turn up in any of your research?
You know, there are episodes in which those kinds of things happened. You know, clearly the raid on Wessagusset is, you know, has those kinds of things happening. But, you know, there seems to be a core of truth to the myth of the first Thanksgiving, which is a myth. I mean, it was not the thing we're taught in elementary school, but there was a celebration. It seemed to have more in common with a medieval harvest festival, but it was much more of a native event than it was an English. They were out. Massasoit showed up with enough Indians that the English were outnumbered by 2-1, and provided five freshly killed deer.
They did feast together.
And, you know, this early, there was not a big Dutch presence in the region. And so, I mean, I think that's referring to subsequent decade where, you know, you do see the Dutch arrive and there is all sorts of infighting with local Indians and things like that. But in there was a gathering, probably not in November, probably in September, October at the latest, in which Indians and English did feast together. And it was not the English around the table with the turkey in the middle, clutching each other's hand as a few Indians looked on. No, it was predominantly a native celebration. And I think in that sense, it's kind of an interesting situation where the truth is a lot more interesting than the myths we're taught.
And Nathaniel Philbrook, one of my favorite historians. He's conversational and engaging. That book, Mayflower, that we're talking about was published in 2006 and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. We'll be back after news with more from Nathaniel Philbrook and a conversation we had earlier this year about his most recent book, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. First now to news with John Wanamaker. Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie. President-elect Donald Trump says he intends to nominate Republican Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The job requires Senate approval, and if she is approved, Haley would become the first female and first non-white cabinet-level official in this administration. She is the daughter of Indian immigrants. The German government says it is repulsed by Nazi-style salutes such as those performed at a recent far-right event in Washington, but the Germans say they have confidence the United States can tackle the issue. Video published by The Atlantic shows participants at Saturday's event raising their arms in salute during a speech by Richard Spencer, head of the White Nationalist National Policy Institute. The salute is illegal today in Germany. President-elect Trump yesterday said he condemned and disavowed groups such as the one involved in the weekend event. Police don't believe an officer was ambushed when he was shot in the head last night while on patrol near a university campus in Detroit. Wayne State Police Chief Anthony Holt says a suspect is in custody, but that he has not been charged. He says no weapon has been recovered and that an investigation is ongoing. He says the officer's condition is very grave and the outcome is uncertain. On Wall Street, stocks are mixed right now as drug company stocks are taking a hit this morning. Drug maker Eli Lilly dropped 14% early today after it said a potential treatment for Alzheimer's disease failed in a clinical trial. That stock down now 8%. Other healthcare stocks also fell. The Dow right now up slightly. The NASDAQ down 0.3%. The S&P 500 down slightly. The markets will be closed tomorrow for Thanksgiving. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
I'm Carrie Miller. Back now to our conversations with writer and historian Nathaniel Philbrook. He sat down with me earlier this year to talk about his new biography, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. In it, he writes, although it later became convenient to portray Benedict Arnold as a conniving Satan from the start, the truth is more complex and ultimately more disturbing. And so I started by admitting how surprised I was by Arnold's insecurities, how emotional and inflamed by grievances he was. I wondered if it was something Nathaniel knew when he started to research the story.
Yes, he was a passionate person, which made him great on the battlefield, but was always getting him in controversy when it came to his fellow officers or politicians. And he was a passionate person. And when the revolution begins, he donates a lot of his own money to the process, to the conducting it, gets himself in financial trouble. He's not, the Continental Congress doesn't recognize his achievements in a way that he thinks is appropriate. And he gets embittered. And what is embittering him is something that's occurring through to all the officers, because the American people went into this revolution because they didn't want to pay taxes to Britain, and they didn't want to now pay taxes to pay for this war effort. Washington's army was withering on the vine, didn't have the funds to conduct an adequate war, and people like Benedict Arnold were suffering. And so he had legitimate grievances.
But I mean, what you just said is very important. He was not being singled out for individual slights. I mean, this was happening to a lot of people who were in the army at the time.
Right. These were young men who had, you know, sort of put their lives on hold to fight for the cause of liberty. And as the war went into its second and third year, they were running out of resources and wondering, why are we doing this? The country doesn't seem to support us, the American people, after the great ardency of 1776, were beginning to turn their backs on the cause. And so Arnold was saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, I'm giving everything but my life to this cause. Are the people, especially is the Congress, our national government, defaulting on the promise we made to ourselves at the very beginning?
You know, I mean, I know the resonance for you is clear. I mean, look at the wars that we are fighting today.
Yeah.
And this perception that there are people who do the most suffering and the hardest work, a small number of them, for the rest of us. And still today we ask that question about whether that is acknowledged the
Absolutely.
Way it ought to be.
You know, and part of the problem during the revolution was that most revolutions in history, what happens is the civil government gets co-opted by the military. And so our Continental Congress was rightfully concerned that if we give the military too much power, that, you know, a dictator will appear, whether it be Washington or someone else. And so they were very, you know, keeping the army at arm's length, reluctant to pay for it. And, you know, but hey, the people's freedom depended on this army. And so it was a very difficult relationship and very hard for officers like Arnold, who were up there in the front line risking their lives and not getting a lot of support.
You just said that the Congress was reluctant to pay for the war. It was extraordinary the way the Congress nickel and dimed Washington and the soldiers and the officers and the rank and file. Extraordinary.
Yeah. And, you know, Arnold, in the first years of the revolution up in Canada, he much of his personal fortune went to it. And when it came time for him to, hey, can I get some compensation, the Congress did everything to dodge him. And part of the problem was the Congress did not have the power to tax the people. And so they really didn't have the power to effectively run a government, let alone conduct a war. And yet, what adding to the problems were an unwillingness to deal with the major issues, the partisanship, factionalism, a dysfunctional Congress is nothing new. And they were much happier focusing on those kinds of issues than really solving the problems, you know, funding this army.
As you're saying this, I know you're thinking what I'm thinking, that this sounds so modern. This sounds so similar to what we're confronting today.
Absolutely. You know, I think part of it is our country was born in a revolution. And each generation experiences its own revolution as the ideals our founding fathers fought for are redefined in a new situation. And so, you know, this chaos, you know, I think we like to look back and think, hey, it was a simpler time. These people knew what they were fighting for and they achieved, you know, miracles. Well, not really. It was much more like we're living today. No one knew where they were going. Their motivations were part self-interest, part altruistic. You know, it was a mess.
When you hear people try to interpret today, just because you've got such familiarity with the founders, when you hear people today try to interpret what the founders meant to do and say and what they were thinking, from a historical point of view, what do you think?
I think it's kind of folly because, you know, the times were so different. And, you know, we have this perception because we're doing it from, we have a historical perspective. You can make it look ordained that this was going to be the outcome. They knew what they were doing and they could look into the future. You know, the truth is they were having a hard time figuring out what was happening in the present. And, you know, what they did an incredible job in retrospect. But to think that they somehow, you know, had the finger on where we should go in a, you know, perfect world kind of situation is just kind of crazy because they were making it up as they went along. And I think it's ultimately important for us to recognize that because, you know, every generation is going through that. And rather than to beat ourselves up, try to find the path that solves problems of governance rather than exasperates those problems.
You know, these conversations, if more of what you just said, they were making it up as they went along, was interpreted and understood today, I think some of the political conversations that we have would sound quite different. I mean, there seems to be this perception that they were all wise and all-knowing, and what they put down on paper and what they said was absolute,
right,
for the time, right?
Yeah, and it was not. It was, you know, I mean, that's what was so fascinating about the Revolutionary War period. It was wide open. You know, there was great creativity, spontaneity. Things were happening in a way that it wasn't, they didn't have the template and made it all. It wasn't a tablets of the law being delivered. It was really a chaotic and turbulent situation. You know, Washington, in retrospect, after the War of Independence was fought, you know, called it almost a miracle that any of this happened. It was not a God-ordained march to victory. It was a desperate, 15-round slugfest with both countries teetering. No one knew where it was going to go. And, and people like Benedict Arnold were kind of caught in the middle of it. And, you know, ultimately, my book is about character because, you know, someone like Arnold ultimately couldn't get out of his own grievances. Someone like Washington said, okay, I'm getting treated poorly, but let's try to see the bigger picture. And that's, I think, the essential difference.
Yeah, the contrast is interesting. That you say of Arnold, Arnold had a talent for rubbing people the wrong way. And yet if a soldier had served with him during one of his more heroic adventures, that soldier was likely to regard him as the most inspiring officer he had ever known.
Yeah. I mean, he was in a battlefield situation. There really was none better. He could, he had this instinctive ability to size up the strengths and weaknesses of an enemy. He was charismatic, a real athlete, and tremendous physical endurance, handsome. And, you know, if you served under him and were in the midst of one of his victories, it was a completely inspiring, you know, experience. But, you know, his passion, which worked so effectively in combat, he couldn't control it in a way someone such as Washington could. You know, when it was just the officers talking in the tavern kind of thing, he inevitably would say something that would, you know, get people angry.
I want to ask you about this because it's interesting that somebody who has both facets of a personality like that, that even in the midst of battle, he could put aside his own self-absorption, right?
To a certain extent. It's interesting. If given a choice in battle,
yeah.
He would always go for the risky, swashbuckling approach. And so what you get is, in one situation, the Battle of Valcour Island, this amazing sea battle fought on Lake Champlain. He battles the British to a draw. It's night comes, and they need to get out. They need to escape from the tiny bay in which they're trapped. And his second in command says, "Let's do the same thing. Let's go to the north and try to go around the island and escape the British." Arnold says, "No, we're going to go through the British line. It's dark. We've all been shooting cannons for 8 hours. We're all deaf. We're going to be able to fit between the trees of the shoreline and the last British vessel, and that's how we're going to do it."
How did he know?
Well, once again, he had this instinctive ability to pick the most risky, but a play that generally worked. And so once again, he leads his men through it one vessel at a time. They sneak past, and then by the next morning, they're 7 miles down the lake, and the British are apoplectic at what's happened. And this is quintessential Arnold. He'll go for that. And, you know, and it also, it serves his men well because they escaped, but it also adds to the laurels of you know, his personality. You know, it adds to that swashbuckling essence of, yeah, there's another Arnold, amazing feat.
So there, this isn't really about altruism. I mean, even when he was assessing the possibilities on the battlefield, there was a what's in it for me.
Yes. Kind of. I mean, you know, okay. It's a fine line with Arnold, because, you know, he was so often victorious. You know, how can you argue with the fact? But it's always interesting how often he is at the center of things when this happens. And you know, if he was playing basketball, he'd be shooting rather than passing.
Nathaniel Philbrick is in the studio with us today, and we're talking about his new book about Benedict Arnold. By the way, also about George Washington. So George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the fate of the American Revolution. And I can see why the contrast was really interesting. We just got a tweet, Nathaniel, from someone who says, "I love that you're devoting so much time to this Minnesota girl streaming from Maryland." And she says, "Revolutionary war nerd." There's a lot of those war nerds out. I bet you're meeting some of them on the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's the delightful thing about going on a book tour is I get to meet readers. And after 3 years of research and writing, I'm kind of passionate about the material and really into it. And then to find that there are people out there who are equally interested in the topic is really gratifying.
Tell me why you think the Revolutionary War still inspires the kind of interest that it does.
Well, you know, it's our genesis story in so many ways.
Yeah.
It's this conflagration out of which we emerged as a nation. And, the fact is, though, we emerged very slowly as a nation. You know, and that's what was fascinating for me in this book is, you know, people are thrown together. They're not only battling the British, you know, trying to win this war, but they're battling themselves. There was really a civil war going on during the middle period of this revolution, and one in which the American people were showing much more interest in fighting each other, fighting out their own rivalries with neighbors, you know, under the guise of politics. I mean, it was a tough time in this country, and you know, much of the seeds of the Civil War to come, you can see in this revolution.
Oh, wow. You know, I remember when you and I talked about the Mayflower, mm-hmm. your book on the Mayflower, that we talked a bit about this idea that you're setting the biographical record straight. Are you adding context to what we already know? I mean, how do you see your role? Are you adding context, or are you saying a lot of what we think we understood about those times, well, the research doesn't really bear that out? Here's what really happened. Here's the truth. How do you see it?
Yeah, well, you know, each one of my books, I write them because I'm curious about the topic, not necessarily because I know everything about it. They begin with a question, and this began with me when I was researching the history of my island, Nantucket. Mm-hmm. I read this account of America from the 18th century by Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur, Letters from an American Farmer. It's a love letter to colonial America, but the 12th letter is a cry in the dark. This utopia, Crèvecoeur, a Frenchman who's come to America that's fallen in love with, is destroyed by the American Revolution. As the patriot zealots move into his town on in the Hudson Highlands, asking everybody's loyalties. And Crèvecoeur is saying, wait, I love this society. This is much freer than France. You know, what's happening? And he's ultimately forced to leave and flees to France. And this was a side of the revolution I had never heard of. You know, I grew up thinking it was a God-ordained march to victory at Yorktown, where a ragtag band of militiamen banded together to defeat the mightiest army on earth and threw off the shackles of British tyranny. And what Crèvecoeur was describing was very different. It was disturbing. It was the patriots actually coming into a town and using the militia as strong men to you know, settle scores with neighbors, take over their homes. And this was a different side of the revolution. And so I realized I want to explore that. And I knew I wanted to follow Washington because I had connected with him with my previous book, Bunker Hill, but how to get out that dark underbelly. And it was Arnold, I realized, was the person with which to examine that. And so I see my role as getting at sides of the story that I wasn't necessarily familiar with growing up, but I know they're there.
But you are indeed correcting the record, though, the historical record with this.
Yeah, and for me, it's a personal quest. Okay. I want to understand. And I, you know, inevitably, like it came with the Pilgrims, where I began to realize, wow, what I grew up with was just such a standard tale and so affirming. And, you know, we want these stories of the past to support us in our convictions that, you know, we know what we're doing. And what I inevitably have found is that, no, they didn't know what they were doing. They were thrown in a desperate situation. They were doing the best they could, but, you know, it was not clear. And you have people with very different motivations. Some people are out for themselves. Others are trying to do the right thing, mm-hmm. but are tortured. And so that's what was unfolding. And inevitably, I think human nature is fairly constant with time.
Yeah, I was just going to say you're telling the more human.
Yeah, and for me, that's story. It's narrative based history I'm writing, and it's the personalities that I find the most interesting.
To the phones, to James in St. Paul. Hey, James. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I was going to add, when I read about Arnold in particular, it strikes me that he's really a British officer on the American side. And by that, I mean, he kind of sees himself as an heir to the knightly and lordly British tradition in the same way Cornwallis, that he feels, or at least he seems to feel, entitled to some glory and to some reward, which is very different from where Washington comes from, and Washington seems to see himself as more of a Roman officer in terms of serving for the good of his community. And that allows him to set aside some real personal hurts that
he encountered.
Right. And you're absolutely right. Arnold, you know, he was for the patriot cause in the beginning, absolutely. But, you know, he had he had ambitions financially. He enjoyed the finer things in life, and being the British officers, promotion was based largely on their personal wealth. That was the kind of environment Arnold would have thrived under if he had had the wealth. Now, and it's also interesting though, Washington was very well off, and so that enabled him to cling to his ideals in a way without threatening. He was able to get along. Arnold had thrown a lot of his personal wealth into the cause, and he wasn't as organized an individual as Washington. Washington kept receipts for everything he did. Arnold just sort of, in his typically passionate and impulsive way, just was all in, and that left him running out of money. And so he gets angry when he can't get the money from his own country, it's interesting. It's hard to pigeonhole him exactly, because yes, he was one of our strongest patriots in the beginning, but he had ambitions to live in an aristocratic way, but he wasn't the only one in the American cause that was that way.
I liked the fact that George Washington, although he's aware of Arnold's flaws and his failings, of course he doesn't know what that's going to lead to. But he doesn't like his extravagances. He doesn't like his get-rich-quick
yep.
schemes. But he also admires
Absolutely.
Arnold. And he holds on to that admiration for a long time, past perhaps when others might have said, he's not of my kind, I'm
right.
not going to have much to do with him.
No, I think Washington had a kind of blind spot when it came to Arnold. For one thing, and this was a surprise to me, by just raw temperament, they were both aggressive. Washington, however, in battle, they went for that aggressive way rather than a defensive way. Washington would eventually learn he had to change as the revolution went on, and that he had to acquire a defensive thing. He could change. Arnold could not. But I think Washington looked at Arnold and said, hey, if I was 10 years younger and not saddled by the crushing burden of command, I could be out there on the field, winning those kind of dramatic, swashbuckling victories that Arnold is doing. And, he needed generals like this, where so many of his generals were caught up in political infighting, and not helping him. Arnold was out there actually winning victories. And so, I think Washington, kind of envied him in one way, even though he did recognize that Arnold had tendencies that were potentially dangerous.
Call here from Farrell in Duluth. Hi, Farrell. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Has to do with the human side of Benedict Arnold. I had just finished reading A Traitor's Wife,
mm-hmm.
a book about the wife of Benedict Arnold, who came from a wealthy family
yeah.
and who liked the wealthy lifestyle. And my take on the book was that she begged him and pushed him and also made his existence somewhat difficult.
I think let's let Nathaniel address that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Arnold had his grievances. He would get terribly injured at the Battle of Saratoga, which was a great American victory that would bring in France on our side. But he was treated badly by his commander there, and he was embittered. And ultimately, Washington, sort of out of the kindness of his heart, Arnold's recovering from this terrible leg injury. He can't fight in battle. But Philadelphia has just been evacuated by the British Army because of the entry of France, and he appoints Arnold as military commander of Philadelphia, this war-torn city, fighting in the streets, and it's a difficult situation for Arnold. Tact was what the commander needed. Arnold didn't have any. He was embroiled in controversy, but he meets this beautiful young woman, Peggy Shippen, literally half his age. She was 18. He was at this point a widower with three young boys. And, he's amidst all this controversy, but he's fallen madly in love with a girl who comes from a family with aristocratic pretensions, if you will, from upper crust of Philadelphia. And she has enjoyed her time with the British officers during the British occupation of Philadelphia and is aghast at what the American government is doing to Arnold as he tries to deal with the city.
So she's feeding
and
his
she begins to,
grievances,
and,
right?
And within a month of their wedding, he sends out his first feelers to none other than Major John Andre, one of Peggy's friends during the British occupation. And so Peggy clearly had a role in all this. You could, and Arnold was, even though he was a very strong personality, he was highly influenced by those around him. It would happen time and time again. And, you know, he was married to a woman who was whispering in his ear saying, you know, why are you going through this? The British have much more appreciation of your worth than this American government that seems to be falling apart.
It's a powerful thing, right? I mean, she's validating a lot of what he already thinks.
Absolutely.
He believes.
You know, and I in the book I refer to a comment that John Adams would make about how lucky he was to have married Abigail, a woman who supported him in everything he did. And he knew of a Philadelphia delegate to the Continental Congress whose wife was a loyalist and was pulling him in the other direction. And he said, if that had been the case with me, you know, I think I would have gone mad. And the fact is, you know, he's speaking to the power. You know, those of us who are married know how it works. And Arnold, who was, you know, on the fence, he was, you know, this is such a tortured situation, bitter. He marries this beautiful woman who just says, look, you know, maybe this
you deserve better.
You deserve,
right?
Better. And what becomes clear in the correspondence that would occur for the next year, more than a year, because it would take a while for Arnold to work himself into a position to actually go through with the treason. Peggy takes a very important role and at one point even restarts the correspondence after Arnold has broken it off.
Rebecca in Iowa is, she says she's from Connecticut, and she wonders if you've ever spoken with historian Bill Stanley from Norwich, Connecticut. He loved Benedict Arnold. Do you know him?
I by reputation, I actually spoke in Mystic, which is very close to there, and met a lot of actually people from there whose forefathers fought in the Revolution. They all have opinions of Benedict Arnold. Some are Arnold fans. There are many who despise the man because late in the Revolution, after he had gone to the British side, he would be involved in the taking of New London that would involve a virtual massacre of American troops. I met one woman whose five brothers, four of them, were killed during that. And she said, you know, I have a hard time with Benedict Arnold. You know, but the fact is, you know, he was one of our country's greatest battlefield officers. If he had died at the Battle of Saratoga,
he'd be revered as
he'd
as
be
a
one of our great
hero.
Heroes. And
wow.
You know, there's a fascinating boot monument at the Saratoga battlefield that is just his boot from his injured left leg. Doesn't mention him by name,
really,
but speaks of the greatest American general we had there. And so Arnold is, you know, this is a tortured legacy. And I think it's an important legacy for Americans to look at, because it speaks to the ambivalence of where we came from, where, you know, at the beginning, yes, there were people with the greatest of motives. And then there were people who began to wonder if their country was letting them down. And, you know, it's a process which I think every generation experiences,
right,
one way or another. And so by pairing Washington and Arnold, I was trying to look at, you know, how it can go in very different ways when at the beginning they seem to be very much on the same side.
That's Nathaniel Philbrick on his latest book, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. You can find the complete interview on my podcast. Search NPR News and Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast.